September 11th, 2008. You're listening to the Infidel Guy Show. Thank you for tuning in tonight. As you can see, I have Hydrazine back now in the forefront. Many of you have requested that I bring Hydrazine back, and I have. Don't forget to check out my YouTube page at, well, youtube.com/infidelguy. Check that out. I've been posting a lot of new content up there for you guys and some old content from some really cool debates. Some of those date back as far as 6 years ago. Check those out. I have quite a number of Kent Hovind debates up there, so you may want to check that out. The topic tonight on the resurrection of Jesus Christ with Dr. Gary Habermas tonight. So if you have any questions, start writing those down. Get ready. You can also call in toll free, 888-503-0802. You can also Skype me under Infidel Guy. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to simply post those in our Ustream interactive video chat room there, and I will relay those on to our guest tonight. And once again, our guest is Dr. Gary Habermas. He's a famed Christian apologist, author, and chairman of the philosophy department at Liberty University. Dr. Habermas will be our guest for the entire hour tonight. Now, Dr. Habermas will take questions from you, the listeners, on the resurrection and any other related issues to the resurrection. A special thanks, by the way, to Jim Lazarus and Chris J. for arranging this program. Really appreciate it. And by the way, you can check out Dr. Habermas's website at GaryHabermas.com. The link is currently up temporarily at InfidelGuy.com, so the live listeners, you can just go there and click there right away. Welcome back to the program. Really appreciate it, Dr. Gary Habermas.
Well, Reggie, I'm glad to be with you. I enjoyed being on last time, and I'm looking for a good time. I've been waiting for this for a long time.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, yes, it was quite an engaging, interactive discussion last time, but unfortunately, yeah, it wasn't very focused, as you kind of mentioned before.
Yeah, but it was still good. Reggie's a good guy, and it was a good chat.
Okay, well, first, I guess a little bit of background. Some people are saying, well, who's Habermas? So give us a little bit about your background, maybe your early beginnings to Christianity and why you do what you do today.
Okay. Well, I was raised in a Christian home, and in my teen years, I started wondering, you know, could all this be true? And that kind of led me on a pilgrimage for more than 15 years, and I got to a point where I wasn't ready to reject Christianity, but I sort of came to the stopping place that one could have faith in whatever one wanted.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean you can claim you have evidence for things.
Exactly.
And I didn't think you could prove the resurrection at that time, which is real strange for people who know me now.
Right.
And I kept going down that path, and I got kind of wilder and wilder in my studies and my views until there was a time when to this day, I wonder if I walked away from Christianity. I may have, but I came very close to becoming a Buddhist, a kind of a non-theistic, or let's say a theistic Buddhist, but with an impersonal view of God.
Right.
And I finished my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation at Michigan State University, and it was on the subject of the resurrection. And I say that wasn't the end of my doubts, but that was sort of the, I use that as a nice round figure for my ideas starting to come together and the method I developed for studying the resurrection. And it's a method I still use today because I was writing that dissertation for a group of scholars at the university, mostly, you know, most of them of whom had, you know, rejected the resurrection. So I had to. There's no way I could say it happened because the Bible said it happened or something.
Of course, which is a very common argument that somebody like me hears all the time, actually.
It is.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you take a different approach, apparently.
Yes. What I started developing in that dissertation is what I call a minimal facts method. And in order to do this, you kind of have to survey the field and see what scholars on the left, right, and center are saying. So I surveyed and continue to survey since that day what is being said about the resurrection in French, German, and English from about 1970 to the present. That's thousands of sources. And what I do is I keep a running track, it's almost 600 pages long now, a running track that simply tells me where scholars are. And this could be evangelicals, but they would have to have, like, you know, an earned doctorate in a university position or something, or it could be all the way down to the other end of the spectrum, and it could be an atheist who teaches New Testament or religion or philosophy or history or some cognate area, and I kind of tally up people's views. I realize you can't make decisions about what happened that way, but you can make decisions about where scholarship is. And then I decided to use only the data which were conceded by about 90 to 100, more like 95 to 100% of everybody writing. So I use this common data, which I call the minimal facts. And I, by the way, I don't argue that it's true because almost everybody likes it.
That was going to be one of the grimmest criticisms right away. It did kind of almost sound like argument ad populum.
Oh, that's a great point.
Mm-hmm.
But I start with it, and I have this view about it. If let's just say 95% of scholars across the spectrum admit fact X, and these people across the spectrum are both believers, unbelievers, agnostics, and, you know, in between, then here's the key point. Then there are probably reasons why that fact is allowed. So I look for two things.
Reasons.
I look for the underlying data which establishes these facts, and then I ask, is the majority of scholarship on the side of that? And I will I vary from this from time to time. But in my writings, I generally will use only those data which are shared by everybody. I don't veer from that very often, and I'm almost never judged for veering from that. So I stay in that middle ground.
Now, what about now, since this isn't science, as some may argue, how do you determine, the population in which you are, the group in which you are respecting as authority on some issues when, it could be quite possible that their bias is skewed already. They have a selective bias, quite possibly, even though you mentioned a few atheists already. But,
I've actually done head counts on that, too. I have a large number of people from the atheist, the agnostic, the highly skeptical communities, the communities who basically would say anything from, you can't say Jesus was raised from the dead, all the way over to he was not and couldn't have been raised from the dead. I've got a large number of those guys in this study.
Right, but surely the vast majority would be individuals who already do believe and are in favor of Jesus Christ existing and the resurrection happening, of course.
For sure the majority believe Jesus exists. Whether the majority actually believe the resurrection, that would be open to discussion.
Okay.
But let's put it this way. I've tried to get almost everybody who is published on in the area who has, I'll tell you how I define a scholar. I will try to find virtually everybody who's writing in the subject who has a terminal degree, and I make exceptions. For example, last time we talked, Richard Carrier was your guest, and we had a good discussion. Now maybe you can tell me Richard's finished his doctorate. I don't know. I would have no problems counting Richard if he hadn't. So I make exceptions because Richard's, proven himself. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when I say scholars who write in this area, I generally look for people who have terminal degrees, who have university posts, teaching or something similar. They publish, and in particular, I'm looking for people who publish in peer-reviewed literature.
Mm-hmm.
So some people might say, well, you didn't include so-and-so in your list, and so-and-so is an English professor at a university with no peer-reviewed publications in the fields of philosophy or religion or New Testament, that kind of thing. So, but I try to, Richard's an example. Richard or Bob Price, Bob's a friend of mine and a really good guy. Those guys would be right there in my literature with everybody else.
Okay.
In other words, I'm not trying to block somebody out because they're, quote-unquote, too radical or too this or too that. If they meet my criteria for, you know, somebody who qualifies generally, you got to be a little, you know, you got to be open to exceptions. But somebody who qualifies to speak on this for those reasons I gave, sure, I have any number. I mean, Garrett Ludeman, for example, the atheist New Testament scholar, any number of Jesus seminar guys are in the list. John Dominic Cross and Marcus Borg, guys like that, they're there. And I've got many, many works by them in this study.
Okay. And but again, the vast majority of these individuals are not really talking about or trying or supporting or arguing for what you're arguing in particular. These are just people who help set the framework for the historicity of your premise.
That's correct. They talk all around it. You might get people who are Christians but who say, I'm doing the wrong thing because you're not supposed to use reasons in your faith. You're supposed to only have faith. And somebody else might say, no, you need reasons, but you don't have enough. And somebody else says. So basically, I try to corral virtually every writing I can get a hold of. My grad assistant at this moment is finishing off a big bibliography of these studies for the last what amount to almost 40 years.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, give us another 10 minutes and start writing your questions down. I know some of you has you have questions already, but please stand by and you know, give us a chance to get into the show a little bit. I see a lot of questions coming in. I will announce when I'm ready to take questions, but just start getting them prepared. Write them down so you don't forget them, and we'll be taking those in about the next 5 or 10 minutes, so get ready here. Oh, and don't forget, and that number, by the way, write this down, 888-503-0802. Call in toll-free. Or you can also Skype us, okay, at Infidel Guy. All right. Now, why the focus on the resurrection and not the historicity and or the ascension? I mean, what is so unique and spectacular or special for you for why you focus on the resurrection? Why have you specialized in that?
Great, great question. Because back in my days when I started wondering about my own faith and came close to walking away from it. Back in those days, I had Christian friends who were saying, study this evidence or study that evidence or look at archaeology or look at the events that are happening in the world today that are just the way the Bible predicted them. Or, you know, they would give me things to check out. And I hadn't read some of this stuff before, so I read and read and read and read. And I basically either rejected a lot of those evidences, or I thought they made some good points, but the point wasn't strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I realized that if the resurrection was what it was cooked up to be, what Christians claimed it was, then the resurrection had the possibility of being stronger than the other evidences because it's a greater event.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it would seem to have built right into it that since it wasn't the resurrection of John Doe, it was the resurrection of Jesus Christ, well, therefore, that would seem to say something about him. And then, of course, that's the very heart of the gospel. The gospel is defined in the New Testament is I like to say saying I do because it's making a commitment. Saying I do to the deity, death, and resurrection of Jesus.
Right.
So I thought, well, golly, the resurrection seems to be right at the center of this gospel, and it doesn't help me to know if Genesis is historical or if some archaeological event in the Old Testament was helpful. I need to know if the center is true, and that led me to the resurrection. So that's why that methodology. And as you said at the beginning of the program, you're right. A lot of people do say things like, you're just quoting Bible verses to me or something like that.
Right.
I will say, first of all, that one of the grad papers I did for a professor at Michigan State was sources for Jesus outside the New Testament, non-Christian sources for Jesus outside the New Testament. But these skeptics I'm talking about, whether it's Bob Price or whether it's Garrett Ludeman or whether it's John Dominic Crossan or the Jesus Seminar, they're not going to go to the secular sources. They're going to go right to the New Testament, and they will let you use whatever data is well evidenced. In other words, I guess an illustration would be, you're reading Homer, the Iliad or the Odyssey, and you're thinking, well, I know this is supposed to be a fairy tale, but I know that some historians, they think that there's some key facts. So you write an article called Undisputed Historical Facts in Homer. Well, nobody has to believe that Homer is inspired, or nobody has to believe that
exactly.
Homer is reliable. In fact, Homer could be a lousy historical source, but you could still know these, I'm just making the story up, but you could know these 10 things about Homer. Well, that's kind of what I do about the New Testament. Sure, I use the New Testament, but I don't use it as inspired or as reliable. It could be an unreliable book, and I would still get these data because, as I said, A, they're supported by the facts, and B, they're conceded by virtually everybody who writes on the subject, left, right, center.
Well, okay. Well, it sounds like your argument for, and you haven't really presented any yet, but just giving some groundwork here, but I'm surely your arguments for the resurrection would work best for individuals that already accept a supernatural Jesus. Am I correct? Or do you think that your arguments could also convince someone who didn't have any prior supernatural beliefs?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, as you recall, last time we had your program, on your program in the interview, we got into that one. I dialogue with some of my own friends who share my worldview. We don't even agree on the answer to that. If you were to say, okay, your question said it will work best with somebody who believes in the supernatural.
Right.
Yeah, I think without any question, people who already believe in Christianity or people who already believe in some other religion and they're open to religion, or somebody who is, let's say, a deist and believes in God but doesn't believe that you pray or worship that God, I'd be on increasingly or decreasingly better talking to them. But I do think there's some things that can be said to those who don't have – let me answer your question this way.
Sure.
Yes, that would be helpful. But I don't think it's strictly necessary for somebody to say, well, I'm out of here because I don't admit your supernatural foundation. I think I would say to that guy, ho, let's talk for a moment, not about arguments about God and that stuff, because I rarely go there, but I'd say, well, let's consider a few things that might make you question your lack of a supernatural foundation. So I wouldn't say entirely it's not just for people who already believe in God. I think there's some valuable things here for those who don't. But your question was, would it work better with them? Yes, obviously it would work better with somebody who already believes in God.
All right, well, let's go there then. An individual such as myself, for instance, even though I'm pretty sure in the vast majority of your presentations, you already kind of assumed that there was a Jesus, and then you kind of worked from there. But a guy like me, when someone like you, for instance, would try to propose to me, well, this resurrection occurred, well, okay, first of all, are we certain that this individual was who he said he was? And that would be my first issue. I mean, first of all, many people argued, did he even exist? I mean, I'm willing to say that there was a figure or even figures that people thought was the Messiah that existed back then. I don't really have any problem with that, of course. I mean, groups always nominate their favorites in antiquity for being some representative of something greater, some God or something like that. So I have no problem with that. But I now have to suspend my entirety of natural experience to say, and this character was killed and rose.
Right.
And walked around and talked to people, put fingers in his holes and blah, 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 blah. Uh-huh. That seems like a huge stretch. And to me, of course, as a skeptic, that doesn't really sound too much any different than any other mythological fairy tale and story. So how are you going to work on maybe convincing someone like me that there's more to it than just that?
Well, if you were to start there, now, I mean, I suppose there's more than one place to start. I wasn't quite sure what in the earlier part of your statement there, whether you were saying, you said you're willing to, you know, groups have superheroes and things like that. But one place we could start is if you even believe the man Jesus. Let's just say.
I'm willing to accept that for the sake of argument. Yes,
first century
Yeshua
Jewish
existed.
Traveling preacher.
Yeshua, I can go with that, sure.
Right, existed about 30 A.D. Okay.
Okay.
And if you didn't, I would have to obviously talk to you about data that we have for Jesus and why very few scholars, by my definition of scholar, very few scholars today would say he didn't exist.
Now, by the way, for my listeners, by the way, for the record, if you want to go there, we can do that later, but I'm pretty sure they'll call in and ask you, because that will be what many of my listeners are going to be curious about. Well, what evidence do we even have that he exists in the first place?
Sure.
But I want to get to the meat of just the supernatural event itself, so that's why I'm skipping ahead.
Now, you're talking about the resurrection, not some other supernatural event, right?
Not right, just the resurrection, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so you're asking for my argument, where I would go?
Sure.
Okay. What I do is I will take – some folks over on the left-hand side of the spectrum, pretty far down on the left-hand side, and I'll say my argument will go something like this. If I survey their writings, mm-hmm. they're going to grant me about 20. I'm just picking any old number.
Mm-hmm.
They might grant me 20-ish little tiny snippets about the end of Jesus' life, arrest, whipping, death, burial, and whatever mm-hmm. happened or didn't happen afterwards. The average skeptic will allow about 20-ish things. And then I come along and I'll say, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to try to out-skeptic you for a minute because I don't need your 20. Let me start with a dozen. So I will use a dozen facts. So sometimes I do it with 10, sometimes I do it with 12, and I'll start with that. And mm-hmm. then when I start talking about these pretty simple pieces of data, none of them are – I obviously couldn't get them on the table if they're supernatural.
Right.
So I'm not asking them – you know, right there to believe in the supernatural. But these are things about the end of Jesus' life. I'll give you some examples if you want. But then, of the 12. But then I basically say, well, no, wait a minute. Maybe I don't even need 12. Maybe I'll take, and it depends on which one of my writings, if you want to talk about it, but sometimes I'll take as few as 4. Sometimes I'll take as many as 7. But I'll stick in that area of 4 to 7, which I call the core facts, the inner circle, let's call them. And I'll say, based on these, say, 7 facts, I think the best argument for them is that Jesus was raised from the dead.
I noticed one mistake, or should I say something that stuck out in my mind right away, excuse me if I'm incorrect here.
No, that's right.
It sounded like it went from individuals' thoughts and opinions about something or something that they're willing to accept as true versus facts. Are those two different things? It sounded like, because earlier you mentioned that I gave them a list of things that they're willing to accept about Jesus, but it didn't sound like that. But for some reason, that just doesn't seem the same to me as facts, things that we all know.
Sure. Let me clarify that.
Sure.
When I say statements that they believe, I mean, I'm just going to pick somebody out of the clear blue sky. I'd say, let's say I took a Gert Ludemann, atheistic New Testament professor. Let's say I took a John Dominic Crossan.
Okay.
I might find 20 things in their books where they're writing on Jesus that they think are facts.
So basically you're just using their own beliefs against them, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And again, I will only use, okay. I use data that have 2 characteristics. Each that the person concedes these
right.
facts.
Okay. Understood. I do the same thing when I construct my logical argument. So I understand.
Right.
You first have to give them something to agree to, and then you follow the steps.
Yeah, we don't have common ground. We're
exactly.
not going to be talking very fruitfully.
Exactly. Okay.
But here's the more important point.
Sure.
Let's say they give me 20. Mm-hmm. Well, the reason we have those 20 in common is because this fella who's very far from Christianity and
right.
maybe doesn't even believe in God,
right.
That guy is going to give me these 20, not because he's being a nice guy and he doesn't want to argue with Gary Habermas. He's giving me 20 because he thinks those are good pieces of data.
But he may not believe it himself, though, correct?
Well, I get them out of his books.
Okay.
Let's say, many scholars today, the way they argue is the way I'm doing it right here. They'll
sure.
say something like this. They'll say, let's put these 20 pieces on the table and see where this gets us. And I'll say, well, you know, 20's nice, but I only need a dozen. And it's not a different dozen. These dozen are a dozen of his 20. And then I'll say, you know what, let's just cut the list down to 4 to 7, and I'll use these 7. And I think I can basically make a decent case for the resurrection based on 7.
Well, let's do that. Work it on me, Dr. Sure. Habermas. Come on, let's do this then. Let's go ahead.
All right, you want me to read a list of 12 to you?
Give it to me, yes.
Okay,
ahead.
I'm reading this out of one of my books. I'll
all right,
read
all right.
And notice, none of these per se are supernatural, obviously, because an atheistic New Testament professor is not going to grant me something like that. So, all right, here are my 12. Want me to just read them all?
Sure. Okay. In fact, many people in the room are waiting, too. They can't wait for this.
All right, good enough. Number 1, Jesus died due to crucifixion. 2, he was buried. And notice I keep that very, very general. So if John Dominic
sure.
Crossan says, yeah, they threw him in a hole.
Right. And again, ladies and gentlemen, we're assuming that some of these facts, some of these ideas are true. So let's go with that. Okay. All right.
Yeah, I'll make it stronger than that. Very few of these are disputed by contemporary scholars by the definition of scholarship I gave earlier.
Okay. All right.
Number three, his disciples doubted and despaired after Jesus died. They doubted and despaired because they thought that was the end of their life. I mean, one of the Gospels has them going back.
I can agree with that. David Koresh, we saw right there.
Absolutely. Yes. It's a good psychological fact. How could you lose the most important thing in your life and not be disappointed 2 days later?
Sure.
Okay, fourthly, now this is the only one in the 12 that I dropped from about 95% agreement down to about 70% agreement. This is the only one that's not as well agreed to as the others.
I knew there had to be one.
There is one.
There's a bridge we must cross.
Right.
Sure.
The tomb in which Jesus was buried was discovered to be empty a few days later.
That's possible.
There's nothing supernatural about that.
Right.
In fact, I'm looking at a book right here on my shelf by an historian who says when you subject the empty tomb, this guy's a skeptic. In fact, he tries to make fun of Paul and disprove the whole thing to Paul and everything. But he says, on good historical grounds, he said the empty tomb is a fact of history. So I'll tell you what, this is just an aside, a footnote, but Lee Strobel, in his famous book, Case for Christ, he starts out one of the chapters by saying a little girl who was killed in the Civil Rights Movement was buried, and when her family got permission to go back and exhume the body and rebury it in another cemetery, they got the casket out, and the casket was empty. And in other words, whatever happened, she wasn't buried there. And Lee's specific point was, empty caskets, empty tombs don't require resurrections. So even that point, I'm only making the point that that's
I agree with you totally. I mean, there could have been some other explanation for how
right.
a body could, tons
right.
of explanations how a body right. could disappear. Yes.
Exactly. The next one, next to the crucifixion of Jesus, the next one is the one that virtually everybody will grant you. And it goes like this. Watch my wording.
Sure.
The disciples had real experiences that they believed were actual appearances of the risen Jesus. They had an experience that they said was a resurrection appearance. Now, I can step in as a skeptic and I can say, yeah, right, you loser. You're wrong, but I will grant you that you think you saw Jesus.
Or at least people told us that they thought that they saw the risen Jesus. At least that they heard that this was the case.
That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Six, this turned their lives around to the point where they were being willing to die for their proclamation. I don't think, I always tell my students, don't ever get yourself in a hook and say, well, you prove Thaddeus died. I don't want to prove any one case. I just want to say they put themselves in harm's way for this message. Seven,
okay.
The gospel message was preached in Jerusalem. That's where the first message, it started in Jerusalem. Eight, this gospel that I defined earlier, the deity, death, resurrection of Jesus, it was the center of their proclamation. So when you ask me,
sure.
why do I go here and not somewhere else? Because this is the center of preaching.
Understood.
Nine, the church began, founded on these teachings. Ten, the day of worship was Sunday, and that was kind of strange because a lot of the people who joined the church in the early days were
Sol
Jews.
Invictus.
And
mm-hmm.
they worshiped on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
11, James, Jesus' previously skeptical brother, an unbeliever, was converted when he believed that he saw the risen Jesus. And then number 12, the same thing for Paul. Paul, a leader of the persecution against the church, was also converted by what he believed was an appearance of the risen Jesus.
Okay. I know a lot of your later points obviously are for debate as well.
We can chat about them if you want. But I mean, even a guy like Garrett Ludeman or John Dominic Crossan or those guys, the vast majority of scholars will grant that Paul and James were both skeptics until they at least thought that they met the risen Jesus. So they'll give you that's those guys' beliefs. You
okay.
can always talk about a person's beliefs.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Paul. He saw a vision much later. Right. He saw a vision of the.
Now, scholars dated about two to 3 years after the cross.
Oh,
two to three
really?
Years after the crucifixion.
That's interesting. I thought that there have been arguments. You've been looking at the literature. Are there other scholars that think much later?
Every once in a while, you read somebody that says 4 years.
But nothing like 10, 20, 30?
Oh, no.
No?
Uh-uh.
Okay.
No. Now, when we're saying that, if I'm the skeptic and you're asking me this, I'm going to say, now, Reggie, remember, this is when Paul thinks it happened to him.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So in other words, I'll read the point again.
Understood.
Paul, the leader of the persecution, right. was converted by what he believed to be a resurrection of Christ.
Understood. Okay.
Right. And then I'll go back, and out of that dozen, I'll weed, let's say, seven.
And of course, he could be wrong.
Who could be wrong?
Paul.
Oh, yeah. All of these facts.
Okay. Right.
Notice I'm couching the facts in terms of what the data say. A person can always step in there and say, now, Paul thought that, but let me tell you why I think Paul was mistaken.
Of
sure,
course,
a person
right.
can always do that.
He got knocked in the head, had epilepsy,
had
whatever.
A sunstroke.
Yes.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Wish fulfillment.
All right.
You know, you can say whatever
now,
you want.
Now, I'm trying to figure out, I mean, even if I follow everything you just said,
right.
I still don't see how that would in any way prove or at least give strong evidence for a resurrection event. I'm trying to figure out how
sure.
did that follow. How did
sure.
that flow? I know what people believe, but how
sure.
did that prove that
by the
that
way, you, the move you just made, I don't know how to show it's a fact, but I can show people believe that. That's precisely the move I'm making when I talk about the disciples, Paul and James. It's what they believe happened. One mm-hmm. note, I don't know if this helps you or not. One note, when you said, I don't know how this proves the resurrection or even gives good reasons for the resurrection. Of those two choices, just for the record, I would never argue that the resurrection is proven in some sort of scientific dictum or apodictic certainty. When I say I think I can argue that the resurrection is the best explanation for the events, I'm talking probability. So that's an important case to make it. And so, well, all right, so you know, you raise a very important question. You go, okay, well, even if,
right.
this is you, mm-hmm. even if I was going to be a good guy and give you these 12, and I'm not sure where I am there, but even if I'm a good guy and I give you these 12, I think you're a mile away from the resurrection.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think what these 12 do, and the seven, the seven are of these 12, so they're the same ones.
Right.
I think what these do is if you said to me, let's just say Jesus didn't die on the cross. Let's just say the disciples were lying. Let's just say Paul was a victim of wish fulfillment. The point is, whenever you come up with one of these naturalistic alternative
yes.
theories,
mm-hmm.
there are checks and balances in this list. I'm not going to run back and quote, well, don't you know, Reggie, the Bible's inspired. I don't do that. So I'll stay in this list, or when I say stay in this list, either stay on these specific 12 or the data that give us these 12. Stay right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, well, what would happen if, this, for the sake of the argument, let's say you and I got to be really good buddies, and over a bunch of football games, we discussed 20 alternative theories.
Sure.
And let's just say, for the sake of the argument, what if these dozen facts were such that they made really serious difficulties for the 20 objections? You see where I'm going?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would say. These 20, on the surface, they argue a resurrection.
Right.
But a person who's skeptical would say, well, sure, they argue a resurrection, but what about this? What about that?
Of course,
what about this?
Of course.
What if these 12 facts and the data that support these 12 facts, never relying on inspiration, what if they could answer the 20 objections?
Mm-hmm.
What if you could say, well, I don't know, convince me Jesus was crucified. I'm really open, but convince me he was crucified. And if I gave you five reasons, six reasons, after a while I'd say, how many more do you need before you can admit he was crucified?
I mean, yeah, I'm right with you. I don't even want to argue with you on that. I just want to get straight to the resurrection.
That's what I would do. Yeah,
okay.
I would do. So in other words, I would use this list to argue not just that the resurrection is the apparent fact that follows from these things, but that this same list can eliminate other possibilities. And here's where my point a minute ago comes in.
Sure.
According to probability.
Okay,
I'm not claiming
exactly.
that I can...
So an option of many. Possibly.
Yes, given several options.
Right.
This is a good one. Those two are
right.
not good ones.
But you think the resurrection is stronger than any naturalistic argument.
That's correct.
Okay, now I must say this as an aside before I forget. That, however, historically, naturalistic explanations have always trumped supernaturalistic ones. every time someone came out and said a supernatural thing has done something historically, science, you know, and looking at things from a naturalistic perspective, we discovered, whoa, that's not true. Demons aren't causing illness. So, I mean, given the strength of that fact of human existence, that naturalism continues to demolish supernaturalistic explanations, why would we even feel that we need to go there with the Jesus story? Even, and I know what you're going to do here, Gary. You're going to ask me, okay, well, give me some naturalistic explanations, and then you're going to systematically go through, find problems
That's
with
right.
them, and find problems with those, and say why the resurrection makes more sense.
All right, let's just say, let's just say for the sake of the argument, you and I live next door, and we watch a lot of football games together. And over those football games, you say, hey, I got a new one for you. What about this? What about that? And what would happen if, theoretically, you came up over the space of 5 years, you came up with 20 possibilities, and you worked on these. I mean, you really honed these things.
Sure, okay.
And we hammered them, and football game's over, and we're still talking for a half hour, and we're wearing each other out. And
okay.
What would happen if at the end of those 5 years you admitted or you couldn't see a way
right.
to pick an alternative theory that accounts for the data?
Well, I mean, I would say that I probably still don't know, but if your theory is just as ludicrous as anything else, I'd probably say, you know, I don't know, and I don't think you do either.
Okay,
I would say just because you have an explanation for something doesn't mean that it's true, because your explanation doesn't really make much sense either.
Okay.
In the scope of our experience.
Okay. Now, what would happen? You said just as ludicrous. What's your definition of that?
Oh, Jesus turning water into wine.
And why is it ludicrous?
There is nothing in our experience at all that can do that without fermentation, without additives, without doing some special chemical process to allow this to occur in a very naturalistic way. That's why. That goes beyond our scope of experience. So it is ludicrous to that degree.
Okay.
It is something that's completely ridiculous. It's not something we experience every day. If we did, it'd become commonplace, and that would be part of our reality. That is
right.
something
now,
that is far beyond our reality.
Right. Now, one thing I would admit and acknowledge right off the bat, miracles, by definition, are rarer than natural events. They have to be, by definition. If not, we'd have more miracles than not, and they wouldn't be very extraordinary.
Right.
If people walked on water every day, I said, you, Jesus walked on water, you'd go, and?
Mm-hmm.
Because you've seen everybody do it.
Right.
But you can remember, this is the point at which you started out the show by saying, last time we were together, we got off the subject pretty quickly and never
yes.
got back. This is the point at which I'd have to go to some of those other things. But I would say, well, Reggie, what if over another football game next week, I said to you, well, I want to argue that many of those same things are going on in the world today, and they are not only happening, they have been checked out, investigated. I mean miracles.
I'd say show me the documentation. I'd
right.
want to investigate it. I'd want an independent ability to go check it out. At least
right.
I need something, even forensically. I need something
right.
to give me some type of push in that direction
sure.
to,
as
anyone would with any claim that's out there, so to speak.
And that's exactly what I would have said to you if we reversed and you were the believer and I were back in my doubting days.
Right.
I'd say, hey, put up or shut up, man. You tell me. So
that's right.
I agree with you.
Of course.
But now the things I have in mind, the type of phenomena, I don't even want to mention them, because the minute I mention them, someone's going to hop off on the phenomena and we'll never get back to the subject. But I'll just say that many of the same things, whether healings, whether prayers, whether life after death, there are some very, very select cases that are being written up today in different journals, including medical journals.
Of course. I mean, where people might not quite understand how someone might have come back after so long or things of that nature.
Well, for example,
It wouldn't mean that it's supernatural, though, just in case, just so you know. Because usually when you're dead, in our experience, when you're dead, you're pretty much dead.
Okay, there you go. That's a good one to hop onto right there. When we had this discussion on your show last time, Richard was saying, well, what in my current experience would allow me to think that these things, that I should even entertain these kind of supernatural.
But those wouldn't be supernatural. Those would be naturalistic or something we just cannot quite understand right now. But we wouldn't think automatically that there was some supernatural force involved unless they already have some type of supernatural bias.
Okay. Let me try one on you. And when you were telling me earlier what your general view is for or against God or Jesus or whatever, do you believe in an afterlife or not?
No, there's no evidence for it, as far as I have read.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now what if, again, I'm very cautious about this because I don't want the rest of the program to be on this question.
Sure.
But what if we're having another football game here and we're sitting here watching and during every commercial we're muting this and we're going at it, arguing back and forth, and I'm saying to you, Reggie, listen, man, I've got X amount of cases, dozens, of highly evidenced near-death experiences which indicate that people have verifiable memories after they're dead as dead can be. Now, let's just say for the sake of the argument, again, we have this.
I looked at a couple of cases of that, but yes.
Let's say you listen, and I can tell you, because I have dozens of them. I have almost 100. Evidence cases, highly evidenced cases. And let's say just because.
Well, I'm sorry, but if I was doing a sample of even more people who said they didn't experience anything, but maybe hear a few beeping noises now and again, I'm sure that would probably be in the millions.
Okay, but how many would you need? Okay, there are all kinds of reasons somebody might not remember anything. You could have had brain damage. You know, for example, heart attack patients very rarely have any memories. You know that, for example, after you have a heart attack, this is why it's so evidential.
Cerebral atrophy because of lack of blood flow.
And even worse, one of the latest things they found is if you have a heart attack, your brain stops working in 11 seconds. So if you have somebody who's at the 20, 30, 40, 50-second mark, which is not very far into a near-death experience, but if you have somebody who is at the one-minute dead mark, and they've had a real heart attack, I don't mean you're having some problems in your heart, but you had a real heart attack, they're brain dead. They're brain dead and heart dead. So if you can come back and tell me something at the one-minute mark, three-minute mark, five-minute mark, 10-minute mark, 40-minute mark, that's pretty interesting.
That is pretty interesting. And I would need to look at those cases individually to make a determination.
I got to be clear about this, too. The guy's not just coming back and saying, wow, I had a great experience, because you could say, yeah, nice dream, buddy, or you must have had a good meal for dinner or something, and it's had some lasting effects in your brain, you know. But I'm talking about people who see something. I'll just make a crazy case up. This isn't one of them, but to give you a crazy example, I'm lecturing in class, and you're in the sixth row, and you pass out, and it looks pretty serious, and they call the EMTs, and the guys come rushing in, and we know that you have a blank, whatever your problem is, at 4:21 p.m. in the afternoon, and they get you stabilized at 5:21 p.m. But during that time, you say, you know, I've kind of drifting up above my body here a little bit, and I was watching all you guys pounding that poor soul down there on the ground, and, I drifted just a few feet from here, and, you know, there's an accident
very common
here on the other side of the building. Something that none of us in the room, let's say there's no windows in the room, and you go, yeah, it's an accident on the other side of campus. This really, really dumb, this red car. I don't know if the person was talking on a cell phone or what, but they ran right through a stop sign and ran into this blue car. Well, you're out, and let's say they can tell that because, you know, let's say you've had a real heart attack. Let's say you're flat brain, flat heart.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then we go to the campus police, and we get a police report. And let's say, you know, people report things, and they're not always 100% right. You know, you can have in a car accident in a court of law, you can have two conflicting witnesses. But let's say, generally, what you said was correct. A red car ran a stop sign, hit a blue car. That's a pretty interesting story for you to be telling me. Anyway, I give that as an example for this reason. As far as we know, you're out at that time. Now, there are some real complicated ones where people are on machines during these times, and there's no brain, no heart. And then they report something that happens two floors away in the waiting room where their loved ones are waiting for them. And they can tell something that goes on in the room. And when they come to, they report it, and they haven't even been reconnected with their family yet. And people can check it out. Now, there's hundreds of those.
Yeah, there are tons of stories like that. There are tons of stories of aliens anal probing people, too. I mean,
well, that's true. But to me, some of the difference, okay, aliens, to my knowledge, the alien stories, They don't get written up. The near-death experiences, as nearly as I can tell, they have been written up in 10 to 20 different medical journals today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't mean to get us off on the topic. All I'm saying is, back to the football game, you and I are talking.
Yes.
You just got done telling me you don't believe in afterlife, and you go, hey, Gary, look, it, you got these 20 facts, and all right, dude. I mean, you know, they point in the area of resurrection, but even if I can't give you a theory that makes sense, and, you know, you've been shooting these things down for the last 5 years, and I appreciate that, but you still believe something ludicrous because things like that don't happen. And I say, Reggie, things like what? And you go, an afterlife? Afterlife, what's the resurrection? What's the primary thing about the resurrection? Afterlife. You said a minute ago, dead men don't do much. Well, if I said to you, well, Reggie, let's forget resurrection for a moment. Let's talk about near-death experiences. And let's say I can...
I guess this is taking...
Here I'm going.
I see where you're going with this, but, I mean, of course, I mean, it's going to take some convincing for me to accept that I mean, accept that. I mean, a lot of the cases I've seen as well haven't been, you know, these are just people saying things after the fact, and it's hard to know when you're in that situation. Sometimes people put puzzles, they put pieces together before they go under, and then they fill in the blanks when they come
sure.
to. And so it's just
they wouldn't know about the car accident outside that happened while they were out.
Well, but who? Okay, look, for instance, if
you
they,
can't put that puzzle together.
Actually, you can, because they can be dreaming about something that's similar, and then if they go outside and they see an image that's similar to the dream, then they'll fill in the blanks because there was a lot of broken images, but we love to fill in the story. And so they'll go, oh, my gosh, you know, I was just seeing this when I was up there. No, not exactly. What you saw was a man looking up into the sky, and you saw a car on top of a woman. You go outside, you find it's actually a woman in the car, and there's a midget on the phone, and there's, like, you know, a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man float. But they don't – and this happens so much. It's this false kind of memory. There are too many cases of this for me to accept out-of-body experiences. But, I mean, if unfortunately
what
this cannot be done in any controlled scientific way, if it could be,
actually,
then I'd be more...
Actually, a couple have been. It's really interesting. But
okay, we'll talk about that then, I guess. I mean, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's for another show. But all I'm saying is, if we were to sit here and go back to our football game illustration, and I just got you to the point where you at least were open to an afterlife.
It's difficult for me, though, Gary, because of contradictory, you know, arguments and evidence that for those positions, and so that's why I know there hasn't been enough evidence for me to accept
right.
that. I agree with you, though. If the afterlife
right.
was
right.
proven to be true, then that still doesn't even really give any credence to the resurrection either, though.
Okay, let's
that would give more credence to the ascension, but not the resurrection.
Okay, let's say after 5 years of watching football and being buddies and talking, you're convinced that the resurrection hypothesis is the best hypothesis. But as you said earlier, it's just as ludicrous as everything else because it involves the resurrection. Now, so let's say we have a resurrection hypothesis. What happens if you're open to the afterlife? Wouldn't you have to be more open now to the resurrection since your big objection
resurrection? How long was Jesus dead before he rose, before he walked out?
By the clock,
yes.
The traditional answer
yes.
would be about a day and a half.
All right, so do you have any documentation at all that shows someone dead, clinically dead, we know they're dead, for over a day and a half, and then they come back to life?
If I did, would it make a difference or not?
If I did, would it
make a difference?
Gary, let me tell you why. What it would do is what it would do would actually make Jesus' resurrection still a natural event.
All right, if that's true. Now, that's a good move. That's a good move on your part. By the way, I have one near-death case at 18 hours and one at 12 hours.
Okay, wait, you said near-death?
Yeah, these are near-death cases where people are pronounced dead in hospitals and spontaneously come to while their bodies are sitting in the morgue or
it's
ready to
cold
go.
Cold and...
Where they're ready to be pushed down to the morgue, yeah.
Yeah, I could see. I could imagine that happening because sometimes the body probably could kickstart and do something crazy and we can't really predict what
it is. I know a case where a woman who had no brain and no heart on the operating table, they tried to revive her over a long period of time. They pronounced her dead. By the way, I talked to the medical doctor in this case,
mm-hmm.
and while the guys were pushing her to the hospital morgue, Twilight Zone-like, she sat up on the table with the sheet over her head. She sat up. They ran and got a doctor. He gave her an adrenaline shot, and then she started giving all kinds of evidential reports about the room she was in while she was dead.
Well, I was going to say that I know that my mother went under once. And I don't know. Do you have another 30 minutes, Gary, after this? Because we kind of went off the track, but I want to jump back and allow some callers.
Yeah, I'm glad to go with you back to the resurrection.
Okay.
I had to answer your question because I realize, back to our football example.
Yeah. Hold that thought. I just want to very quickly tell you how I know that. Remember, sometimes...
Your mother.
Our experiences, my mom once said that she could hear everybody. She said she could even see people in the room and all that stuff. But her memories were simply fragmented from all the medication and from everything else that was going on. But I told her, did you know that you could actually hear? I mean, you can construct.
Yes, you can.
You can construct images with just hearing.
That's correct. How close to dead was she?
Pretty close. They said if they didn't start working on her, she would have died that day. So she was just... within a few minutes, they said, actually. This is, she would die within a few minutes. So she had something wrong with her heart, something like that.
Is your mom a believer or a Christian believer or not?
Not now.
And you talked her out of it, right?
That's right. I sure did.
Is that true?
That is true. That's very true.
I'm just kidding, but anyway.
But it's very true. But And she realized that, you know what, after we talked about it, she said, you know what, I think I probably did construct, because I did see the room at first. Or at least, I mean, we all have seen hospital rooms on television. Or visited somebody, right. So we kind of have a good idea what it looks like. And then when you're going under, there's all kinds of stimulus that is occurring that you might not be consciously aware, but your subconscious, your dream state could reconstruct those things. There's a light overhead because you still have some stimulus from the light, et cetera. And that, me, by the way, case in point, drugs, anesthetic does not work very well on me. I am one of those cases, by the way, that I can hear everything and I can feel stuff when I'm under. I'm one of those.
The only thing I want to know is, can you feel the knife?
you feel a dull feeling, and it's not pleasant, but you can't jump off the table or anything like that. It's the weirdest thing. It is so strange. It is because you know you're being sliced into, but it's not a.
Right.
It's the weirdest fear ever. But anyway. But considering all those other factors, medications and all this various stuff,
right.
And then, of course, I'd be curious about what kind of brain damage these people experience as well. I mean,
that's the crazy thing. I mean, one of the cases I know of a little girl who drowned, she was 9 years old. It's a real case. She was underwater for 19 minutes.
Her body went into conservation mode.
Well, that's usually like in cold water. This is in a warm water. This is a swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
This is a swimming pool. And she was brain dead. The doctor in attendance gave her a 1 in 10,000 chance of surviving with brain function. By the way, he was an agnostic. And he gave her a 1 in 10,000 chance of surviving.
His experience, right.
I'm sorry?
Based on what he's experienced in the past, sure.
Right. And mm-hmm. when she came to spontaneously, I say spontaneously, I mean she was in ICU and 3 days later she came to, and by spontaneously I mean they didn't do anything extra to her. She just popped up one day like that woman on the cart going to the morgue.
And now she's an idiot savant.
Pardon me?
Now she's an idiot savant.
Yeah. Well, she says to the doctor when he comes in the room, now she was brain dead when she came to the hospital. He was the mm-hmm. doctor on duty, and she said to him when she woke up, this has been written up in a medical journal, by the way, her whole case, a whole article just on her case.
Well, you know, we will Google it, but okay, go ahead.
All right, and he said to her, she said to him, hey, thanks for saving my life a couple days ago. Appreciate that. Where's the tall doctor with the beard? There were two of them who worked on her, and he said, he's an agnostic, and he said, yeah, I'll go get him. And they got the doctor, brought him back. They sat there, and they said they took notes for 1 hour on what she had been telling them. And she said, the night I, quote-unquote, died, she said, that night, I was allowed, she said an angel came. Now, there's an angel named Elizabeth. Now, there's no test for Elizabeth, so there's no checkpoint here with reality. But just a little girl's story. She said an angel named Elizabeth, she's all tied down in ICU with all these machines on.
And they're busy opening up her eyes and looking into her pupils all the time. Who knows? Maybe quick little snapshot. It's hard to say.
Okay, I mean, even if you said that, I think they left her alone. But, I mean, let's just grant that. She said, this angel allowed me to look into my home to see what my parents were doing. And she said, this is as soon as she comes to.
Sure.
She told what her brother was doing, what her sister was doing, where her dad was. She said, my mom, they left the hospital, as I recall the story.
Oh, so she's flying around now. Interesting.
Pardon me?
So she's flying around, essentially.
Well, I don't know if she's flying around or if she's able to see it from where she is. That's always been a question.
Remote viewing. Interesting.
Remote viewing. Anyway, so the doctor said, okay, so what was your dad doing? What was your brother doing? What was your... And then when she got to her mom, she said, what was your mom doing? And she said she was making dinner. And they said, all right, there's a point of reference to the real world. They said,
exactly. She always makes dinner.
What was she cooking? And she said, roast chicken and rice. So the guys wrote down, the two doctors wrote down roast chicken and rice. When the parents came in to see her, he points to the wife and he says, what did you make for dinner two nights ago?
How do you do that?
I had chicken and rice.
I don't understand. Why would they even do that? I mean, usually doctors would be so concerned about everything else. Why are they going to write down? I just don't, I mean, that's the weirdest thing.
Yeah, it's a good point. she came to when she was just conversing with him, like, every day.
Right, and for some reason they said, you know what, I think she probably really did see this, so let me write this down and then let their parents, you know, hey, did you guys really?
They're checking it out. But the guy, the chief doctor, the head doctor, who was a pediatric brain specialist, he was the agnostic. I don't know what the other guy was, but I talked to this guy for hours, and he was an agnostic. Anyway, he now is some sort of theist who believes in an afterlife. Now, beyond that, I don't know if he has any specific beliefs, but he studied about 20 of these evidential things, and he's now, changed his mind.
All right, I'd love to know his name.
You tell his name. But back to the football thing, we're sitting there, and if you're, I think almost everybody's big objection to resurrection is afterlife. It's like you said, dead men don't do anything. Well, if I said to you, well, here's a bunch of dead men that seem to be doing something, you couldn't quite as easily say, well, resurrection is the best thesis.
If true. I mean,
so far-fetched, or whatever your word was you used earlier, fantastic or whatever, I'd say, well, it's not so fantastic if other people have seen little things. And then you'd go, by the way, your point was really, really good. You'd go, well, then you know what? The resurrection of Jesus is looking to me not to be very supernatural.
Right.
And I would say, well, Reg, we're going to have to sit there. We're going to have to talk about whether... Pardon me?
Yep, I already know where this is going, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we're not talking about the bag lady on the street. We're talking about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He's the and how many other people do you know who were raised after a day and a half? And here's one for you. Near-death experiences, the little girl's body, when she came to, where's her body? Well, she's talking to the doctors. Where's Jesus' body? Well, the tomb's empty.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever happened to him happened to his body. Then Paul sees him later, and an account that critics love, talk about that if you want, but the account that critics love is the Acts account where Paul says he was blinded by Jesus' light. Well, that's not your normal body either. So if you said to me, all right, I'm open to afterlife. This is, we're talking for years now, watching a lot of football, and you go, all right, look, I'm open to afterlife. I'm open to resurrection. But now you just got me thinking it's a natural event. Well, then I give you a bunch of reasons why this can't be natural. The little girl can be, but the Jesus case can't be.
And I guess that would be the rub is like, why would something just not be an inexplicable natural occurrence? Because, I mean, people back in a long time ago believed that any single event that affected man that was unexpected or disastrous or even helpful, they thought that the gods were responsible for it. They thought that there was something spiritual. Sure. But as we gain more knowledge about the human condition, about nature, about environment, we now knew the root causes. So isn't it just as plausible that we simply do not understand what these... Because we have a historical precedence. You see what I'm saying?
So, in other words, now you're moved from atheism to agnosticism.
Not at all. I was saying.
No, I mean about the resurrection. You'd say, now I just don't know what happened.
I don't know. I understood. Not theological agnosticism, but you mean just not knowing about this particular.
Yeah, like if someone really pushed and you're going, that can't happen because there's no God.
There's nothing wrong with that. You're right, because there are tons of things we don't know yet, and we're still trying to figure out how these things work. So if all these instances you mentioned were true, there's no doubt that eventually, inevitably, because historically we have this being the case, that we will, with enough research, find out exactly what's going on. But again, Gary, historically, though, this has not been going into the in favor of supernaturalism. This has always been in favor of a naturalistic explanation, though. Historically, has always been the case.
Always.
Can you think of any case in which supernaturalism has trumped the natural?
Yes.
Besides Jesus.
What do you do with the? I'd want to talk about 100 near-death experiences. I would want to talk about
But those experiences just now, though. I just said, what if we? But, okay, well, first of all, I don't even know if those experiences are true, so I guess it's hard for us to relate to what
know. What I'm saying is there are sure some phenomena I can put on the table. I just finished a book. It hasn't come out yet. I have some cases of spontaneous. I know this is, sounds like Twilight Zone, but I'll tell you what. I won't give you the cases because I want to get people.
Yeah, because that's one of my criticisms. If you're going to say spontaneous regeneration of anything.
No.
Okay,
no,
I was about to say.
But I would say spontaneous remissions of cancer.
Oh, that happens all the time.
What I mean is where it's gone in 24 hours. I don't mean it's gone in 3 weeks. I mean it's gone in 24 or 48 hours. When someone is prayed for.
Oh.
I've got some cases, and the medical guys will back it up.
Okay, well, yeah, okay.
You're
right. We're definitely going totally off track now.
I don't want to. So all I'm saying is this. When you make your comment that everything in the world that can be investigated, naturalism always wins, I go, wait a minute.
Historically,
I got five cases over here.
You're talking about modern instances now in which we are still ignorant. I'm talking about things in the past consistently over time. As we research more and learn more, Gary, we have found out what word a catalyst is involved in many, many different things, and we continue to keep moving in that direction progressively. It's not receding. It's not getting worse. It's not like scientists are throwing their hands up saying, we just can't ever figure this out.
Yeah.
But if you're going to say,
well, what about Dante's Hell or something in the Middle Ages? Here's the classic case. The eclipse is now explained according to astronomy. But let's just say, for the sake of the argument, that there are the same sort of near-death, healing, whatever, 1,000 years ago. How do you know that you're just not assuming that science has answered those questions instead of what's maybe, I mean, you have to be open, maybe science did not solve that particular case.
Okay, well, granted, for the sake of argument, that could be the case, but so far that hasn't been proven in any way. So far, even believers accept certain scientific advances. They don't sit around and
sure.
go, well, I don't
sure.
know. I mean, I want, you know, I'm, did God make that concoction, or did you do that, or where did that come from?
I hear you.
Yeah, we assume that the science is true because it works. And for, well, most well, a lot of the times.
Let's put it this way. If there are anomalies today that look like quasi, quote-unquote, miracles, we can hedge the words however we want.
Yes.
If there are phenomena today that are candidates for supernatural events, all I'm saying is I'll bet you there were events that were candidates for miracles back in the Middle Ages, too. In other words, I don't think
science has
explained everything down through the ages. I don't think today's science would explain everything that happened in the 14th century.
I want to make sure that, yeah, I didn't mean for it to come across like that. I wasn't saying we've explained every single thing up to this point.
Or that we could.
Obviously, we don't have the tools currently, no. I said, but I'm saying historically, though, that in many, I guess I did say every, but I guess I mean in many of the cases in which there was allegedly a supernatural cause for something, we learned that there was something else going on with that. And we continue to do that, and that is a progression.
Except
in
for these hundreds of cases which we have question marks by because we weren't able to do that for them.
Well, and some did have question marks, and then we figured those out. I'm pretty sure.
I would just go back to NDEs. There was a young lady, like
waking dreams, for instance. We figured that out. We did not understand hypnopompic and hypnagogic dream states for a very long time,
sure.
Gary. But now that science has come along and we can induce these, we've seen we can look at the brain and we see how these things are occurring. We no longer need a supernatural explanation to say that my soul has somehow jumped out of my body and this is occurring, or I saw my grandmother touch me. We now know that waking dream states can induce these exact same experiences.
Sure. Sure.
So that's another example for me. So that's a score one again for naturalism.
Well, on the dream thing, yeah. But Reggie, I don't want to be the one to have gotten us off the subject. So let me just say, it wasn't you. I'm not blaming it on you. I'm just saying the reason I went over there was because you were saying to me, well, if the resurrection is the best explanation, you still have one crazy thing doing a better job than other crazy things. That kind of comment you made, and I'm saying, well, what if it's about a realm that's not so crazy? What if you have other reasons? If the only thing against the resurrection is we've never seen these kind of things before, if that's the only thing still lurking, and all the facts look good,
what I mean about that is that there is a rational reason to doubt it. I do not need to accept it.
But your rational reason is what? Naturalism is true?
My rational reason to doubt it is because of our experience historically. that whenever we've seen these supernatural.
The minute you say experience historically, I'm saying yes. That's what's weak.
Why do you think that's weak when that's one of the bases of developing new science and
sure
evolving is through this method?
Sure it is, but science can only talk about things it can measure and so on and so on and so on. There are many, many things science can't measure.
Right.
For example, this stupid example, but I mean, science can't tell mm-hmm. me I'm in love with my wife. There are things in the world that science can't measure. Now, you can maybe tell me what an emotional state looks like.
Of course.
But what I'm saying is, I don't want to keep going back and back and back, but I'm just saying,
yeah.
If I have different kinds of experiences, there
sure.
are experiments with answered
okay.
prayer, there's healing, there's NDEs, and then if I wanted to bring in, if I wanted to talk about God, which hasn't even come up, but I mean, then I'd say, now, Reggie, with all of those kind of things, you should at least not rule resurrection out without looking at the facts.
I'll look at it. Yeah, sure.
Well, obviously, because you have me on the program.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you go back to the resurrection data. I'm just trying to answer that question, which says, this is really, really interesting,
but, you know,
but
Gary,
the world's not
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. No, I understand, but I understand exactly what you're saying. You know, if you, and I see why it's continuing this way, because if you can find an adequate wedge for me to, if I can open up that door a little bit and allow you, allow me to admit that these incidences do occur, then obviously it's an easy leap and jump to the quote, as you would probably say, a fact that Jesus resurrected.
Yeah, but let's put it this way.
It's an easy jump to there.
I know Anthony Flew's a bad name in some of your circles, but back in the days when he was, when he and I debated for the first time back in 1985, he was much, much younger, and he said he didn't believe in God or anything. But he's got a famous comment. It's in print. Our book was published. He said, totally different subject, but a relevant point. He said, if there is good evidence for God, just the point you just made, he said, if there's good evidence for God, then I don't need very much evidence at all to go from there to resurrection because the door's already been opened. I'm just suggesting there's a bunch of doors that a naturalist would have to shut completely. God, prayer, healing,
near-death
experience.
Or it could be that the believer in those things has opened up far too many doors unnecessarily.
It could be, but these are relevant things that have to be put on the table, and I'm suggesting that a person shouldn't say, well, you've got some good and interesting facts for the resurrection, but you have to understand I'm not open to that phenomena because nothing happens after death. I'm saying, well, here's some other stories that should make you open to that. Then I go back to the resurrection.
Right.
I'm just showing you how I would move
understood.
If I were in a
understood.
Dialogue.
I mean, and I wish you had, you know, the names of all the documents and stuff like that. But
I do. In fact, most of them are in my publications.
Oh, okay.
I have a publication.
By the way, Gary, I hate to do this. I really do. But folks have been dying to call in and talk to you. And I know you're
not
really.
Surprised. It's already 9:15. So.
Right. And I know you're not finished, really. But I think many of us kind of get the crux of that.
All right.
And so,
I'll stop right there.
And so I think I'll leave some.
By the way, you've been very, very kind and very understanding.
I appreciate
the two-way chatter and just not feeling that someone's not saying to me, no way.
Right,
you're not like
right.
that at all. You're open-minded. I really, really
no problem.
That.
So I'd like to, if I may,
sure.
kind of surmise that what you are pretty much doing is just analyzing, analyzing the probability that that could be the case.
That the world's bigger
right.
than we think.
And if that is the case, then just as we accept many other things based on probability, uh-huh. then why not go ahead and accept that?
That's a good point. Based on this data that I outlined
right.
earlier.
And now that's a historical precedent for you.
That's correct. Pardon me? That's our historical what?
Precedent. Now that's what we do historically. You know.
Yeah.
We use percentages
all the
time.
And that's
why I would
go back to the facts and I'd say, and you could say, or one of your callers could say to me, great, open-minded, great. I'll give you open-minded all day long. Let's talk about resurrection. And that's where I go back to those 12 facts.
All right. So here we go. 888-503-0802. You're listening to the Infidel Guys Show. We have somebody's closing the door right now. Somebody just called in. But we're talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ and other things. I have somebody on the line right now. Hello, you are on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Reg? This is Ash, the Inquirer.
Damn, that's loud. Hold on. There we go. Okay.
I know where this is going because, I mean, I studied and was a former evangelical, so I can kind of feel for it. But really, all the evidence that's been presented so far, at best, kind of shows that this is something that might have happened.
Of course.
And that there's a wealth of other things that have could just as well have happened as well. But, you know, what we have is a statement from Paul saying that amongst that if this didn't happen, they're amongst all men that's most pitiable. Maybe this is more of a theological question. Why did an omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent creator choose some of the most questionable lines of evidence to prove one of the most important events, not one of the most important, if you go with what Christian's saying, in human history? Why, you know, we've got at best, granting every argument, a group of about, you know, at best 12 people saying that this occurred, just by and large, all of whom are believers. You know, and we all have Paul's word that he wasn't.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah, and I missed your name. Your name is what?
Ash.
Ash, okay. That's when the phone was jumping there. Well, first of all, as I pointed out earlier, good question, by the way. Two of the people on my list, James and Paul, were not believers before they saw Jesus. And Paul does tell us that he was not a believer.
James was it?
James, the brother of Jesus, that's correct. And Paul tells us personally.
Wait a minute. What's your proof of that?
Of which one? James? You said James.
James,
you said Paul.
Yes.
You said Paul doesn't say that. In Galatians chapter 1 and in Philippians chapter 3, two books that nobody disputes are Pauline, so critics would let me talk about Galatians and Philippians all day long. In Galatians 1 and Philippians 3, Paul says, I was persecuting the church, trying to imprison or kill people who named the name of Jesus, and Jesus stopped me in my tracks, especially, he says this in Galatians 1.
So we have to take his word for it, kind of like when Muhammad said that the angel Gabriel visited him, we have to take his word for it, too.
Yeah, well, except the difference is, ask somebody for evidence for their claims, and when you say, well, what's the evidence that Paul saw Jesus? Now we're going back to the historical facts. But I was only addressing your question when you said Paul doesn't say he was an unbeliever. He does. Now, that doesn't mean it's absolutely 100% true, but he does say that. He does say that in at least two of his writings.
My original question, which is what I was looking for an answer on, is why does this creator who has access to all of the world's evidence available, certainly, choose some of the poorest? We just got to take everybody's word for it.
What should he have done? Should he have, like, put this on television?
Cross on the moon.
Pardon me?
Cross on the moon.
A cross on the moon. Oh, you mean something.
you mean doing something where everybody in the world can see it.
Right. Okay, that's what he's saying.
Not even just everybody in the world. Something that doesn't require, you see, like what Reggie was talking about earlier, there have been hosts of studies on sleep paralysis, sleep dementia, and these are experienced by people of variety of different faiths, and when they come back supposedly from the dead, they have a whole bunch of different interpretations from Christian to Hindu to New Age. And you know that, so there blows the 100 NDEs out of the water.
Not really. I don't think he'd agree with that.
Totally poor means of evidence for the most number one
that supports his argument.
The thing that Paul says we're pitiable without.
Okay. Well, on your cross on the moon argument.
Let me take some more calls. Thank you for the call. Sorry, go ahead.
Thanks for a good question. The cross on the moon or something like that kind of question. Personally, I believe the line of philosophical reasoning by people like Pascal and people like that who say that God does not want, if he gave a cross on the moon, if he let Jesus be raised on national television, then he pretty much is saying, y'all aren't going to have any choice. You're all going to come into Christianity. I don't care what you want to be. You're all going to be Christians. You can't deny this. There'll be a few poor souls who would deny it, but there's the cross on the moon. There's the resurrection on CNN. Keep it on your, you know.
Yeah, the cross on the moon kind of sucked because that could have been done with, like, I don't know, a huge laser or something. I don't know. Aliens messing with it? I don't know.
Okay, that's a good point.
I have a much better argument, but go ahead.
But what I mean is, I don't think God, the caller is correct if his assumption is that God is not into giving us the kind of evidence
that's right
that gives nobody a choice. Let me give you a human example.
No, I'm sorry. What do you mean choice, by the way? Choice about what?
Well, for example, when I got married and I decided to have children, I think almost every parent goes through this. You realize you could have children who are to this or to that or problematic here. Or
yes.
If you're Christians, they could become atheists.
You have an idea, but you don't know everything absolutely, but yes.
Listen, a guy could, you know, somebody's children turns into a murderer. I know that, but I still decide to have children.
Well,
because
if you knew, though, that your child would be a murderer and kill 1,000 people, you probably wouldn't have them.
Well, you think so?
I wouldn't.
I mean,
would you?
Would you know that ahead of time?
Wouldn't that be immoral to do such a thing if I did know ahead of time?
Okay, what would I do about it?
Not have the baby.
If God
don't have any sex. I mean, I'd be too afraid to have sex.
I'll bet you wouldn't stop. Anyway, another subject.
Okay.
Let's say God's in that position.
Mm-hmm.
So God's going to step in and do a quote unquote miracle every single time something's going to go wrong with this creation. Right? What you want to do? You want God to stop Jack the Ripper every time he goes to do something.
Well, in Christian theology, if someone believes that they are, that God is protecting their family through prayer and faith, and Jack the Ripper still rips them up, that...
But what I mean is, we both said earlier, a miracle by definition is something that's rarer than the natural events.
Right. Even in naturalistic terms, you hear even laymen would say, even not in a religious sense, right, they would say, wow, that was a miracle, even though it was just, might have been something just...
Yeah, they mean it's an extraordinary
event. Right, right.
But if God stopped every Jack the Ripper, every drunk driver, every person who's talking on a cell phone when they go through, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
We would not be talking about miracles. The world would be a totally different place than it is now. It seems to me the kind of God I believe in is mm-hmm. a kind of God who allows possibilities, who gives evidence, but doesn't coerce anybody to believe.
That cannot be really true. I mean, in the Old Testament, Yahweh went down and sat and ate and drank with 72 elders. So he obviously has made himself, he didn't seem to care then.
Oh, wait a minute. He raised Jesus from the dead. What I mean is there are miracles in the Bible. I'm not saying...
Gary, my argument is that I think you're trying to talk about that we wouldn't have a choice if that's the case. Well, he didn't seem to care then. I mean,
because
so...
he's talking to people who had already theoretically chosen for him, correct?
Oh, so... But,
is that the 72 elders?
But they had to have some type of... I mean, people just don't believe things out of thin air, correct? They have to be exposed to these things. And,
right,
and,
but he's appearing to his people.
Right. So
what
But he doesn't even appear to Christians today. Aren't they his people?
No, you're saying that to the wrong guy, because I'm going to pull some more of it. I'm going to pull some more cases out, because I think this world is way bigger, that we have data. We have data
really?
Against naturalism at every turn.
Well, I mean, I don't understand. Okay, this is the thing.
But Gary, let's talk about,
but hold on. 888-503-0802. You're listening to the Infidel Guy Show. Don't forget, you can also Skype me at Infidel Guy, and I will start looking more in the chat room now for your questions. So if I missed them, ladies and gentlemen, please feel free to start doing that right now. I think I have someone in line, and I'll come back with my point in a minute. Hello, thank you for holding. I'm sorry. Hello.
Reggie, this is Don.
How you doing, Don?
I'm doing all right.
So
I'm listening to this and listening to, you know, what Gary's talking about and all of this and this conversation, and it seems to me this is all just, you know, mashed potatoes and corn and broccoli, really. This is a side dish. You know, when we talk about this entire issue, I like to go right for the steak, and that is the existence of the supernatural itself. I mean, it's all fine, well, and good if you want to postulate the supernatural, but you had better actually be able to provide the ontological backing for that claim.
Right.
This is, you know, what Gary is talking about, all this stuff, what theists do, you know, they postulate the supernatural, and it is what one of my friends calls the Pythagorean hangover, that is trying to separate reality into two realms, one that we exist in and then some other, you know, higher realm. And quite frankly, Gary, you don't have any ontological reason to do this. You have no, you just simply have nothing. You've just got, you know, this is what I'm saying and that's it.
John,
so if you would be ever so kind as to provide the ontology for the supernatural, I would be grateful.
Okay.
Thank you for the call.
Ontology simply means what is real, what is. It's not, for those of you who haven't studied philosophy, it's not a trick term for something really deep or really, I mean, it's a deep subject. But if there is a resurrection, we started tonight, and Reggie, one of the first questions Reggie asked me was, why did you center on the resurrection? And I said, because it was, I just thought it was different than all the other sorts of religious claims. If a man named Jesus was raised from the dead, and that's a question tonight, if this man named Jesus was raised from the dead, what I'm arguing, Don, is that there is an ontological reality beyond the reality that we see right now. In other words, data for the resurrection would be the ontological reality, but so would, and I mean, I know listeners out there are going to go nuts, but I mean, so would intelligent design, so would near-death experiences, so would a miracle, so would, in other words, somebody would have to grant me this. If those things happen, it would indicate a different ontological realm. So, I mean, to say that I haven't given an ontological underpinning is to miss the fact that what I've been doing tonight is talking about ontology. To say, my argument is, the world is different than many of us think it is. That's where I was going. That is ontology.
All right. I think he called back in. Hello? You're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Oops, very loud. Go ahead.
I had a question. How do we really know that there really was an empty tomb? Because I was looking at or listening to some of the statements that were made earlier, and when you talk about the majority of scholars, Bart Ehrman, almost all the members of the Jesus Seminar, Marcus Borg, and so on, all question the presence of a tomb, talking about the common practice of the day was burial in a shallow grave for criminals, even amongst the Jews, which was actually a legal practice, according to the Mishnah, the Talmud, and so on. So really, all we have in 1 Corinthians 15 is the mention of the death and resurrection. We don't have an empty tomb. We have it partially mentioned in Mark. It seems to be just a progression, a legendary one, which there was more than adequate enough time to do so. What real proof do we have of a tomb?
Okay. Evidence for an empty tomb. By the way, there are a number of scholars down on the left who do believe in empty tomb. I gave an example earlier. The guy's name was Michael Grant. He's the historian who goes after Paul and says Paul didn't have an experience on the way to Damascus, but he says according to historical principles, an empty tomb. Another example is Geza Vermesh, a retired professor of Jewish historical studies at Oxford, who just recently wrote a book on the resurrection of Jesus and argues for an empty tomb. He's not even a Christian. So there are people who are going to argue that. It's not only believers who believe in empty tomb. Now, the question about evidence. When you go through the sources I mentioned earlier tonight, there are more than 20 different arguments for the empty tomb. Now, Reggie, do you want me to pause and mention three or four of these real fast?
Ooh.
I don't want to take more time than you have.
It's getting pretty close here.
How much time do we have?
Just another 8 minutes, really, if I can. I'm trying to squeeze these calls in here.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you want me to hold off on arguments for the empty tomb, I'll be glad to come on some other time and we can talk about the empty tomb.
Sure.
But I will just say this. And of course, someone's listening is going to go, well, there he goes again. He's just saying things. But I have a list of 23 arguments for an empty tomb, not that Habermas made up. These come from the list of scholars. I collated these from the list of scholars. There's about five of them that are really, really worth talking about. And because of those, a lot of skeptics, like the fellows that this guy mentioned, people who are going to not believe in a resurrection,
right,
believe in an empty tomb. I'll just leave it right there if that's good enough.
Okay,
for you.
Thank you very much. One more call here. Hello, thank you for holding.
Hello?
Yep, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Eric in Athens. I was just listening to all the points that Dr. Habermas made, and it seems to me that they all depend on the idea that the Bible and the Gospels are reliable history. Would he say that if the Bible is not a reliable history, that the resurrection argument goes out the window?
No, we covered this real early in the discussion, and I would say you could make the argument I'm making and not believe in inspiration, not believe in a reliable Bible. You could even have, I use the example of Homer. You could even have a book that you might conclude is not very reliable historically, and you can still get these 12 facts that I'm working with, because many of the guys I'm talking about, that's their view. Their view is that the Bible is not a good source, and they'll still grant me these 12 facts. So there's no possible way that I'm smuggling in inspiration to get these facts.
Because
people who are way down to the left who don't believe anything like inspiration, they would sneer at inspiration, they will still grant these 12 facts. So there's obviously reasons they grant those 12 facts. That's the key, the reasons they grant them.
Vincent from the chat room is asking, does Habermas believe Muhammad flew up to heaven on a winged horse? Why or why not?
Well, okay. Now, here I'm going to sound kind of skeptical. I'm going to say, now I've been told by a Muslim friend, I'm open to being corrected by Muslims, but I'm told that that was not supposed to be an historical event, that that was a revelatory event, something that God showed him, like the book of Revelation. That was the example that was actually given to me. So maybe they're not even claiming it's like that. It's not, by the way, that's not after his death. That's not after his death. Muslims, again, I'm open to being corrected, but Muslim believe that Muhammad died. They don't believe he was raised again. So the horse incident did not happen after death. But why don't I believe it? I'm going to sound like Reginald here, but I don't believe it because I don't see any data for it. Now, see, unlike the argument I gave, you'd have to, in my view, you'd have to be committed to the Quran. And if you're committed to the Quran, that's your right, and that's fine. But you'd have to be committed to the Quran to believe that story.
Now, what if there were tons of witnesses that told you they saw an event that isn't theologically consistent for you, or that mirrors?
Like
the gurus in India who can make the sun stand still or make the sun bounce on the atmosphere or things like that, and thousands of people say they saw it, would you accept their...
Here's where I'm going to apply my own principles to me, and I'm not going to squirm out of this.
Okay.
I would get in there, and I would investigate it with the same fervor that I've gone with resurrection, and if I believe the data say it happened, I would have to make room for it in my worldview. Yes.
Okay.
Heard it here. Yes.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, I don't mean to... Do you mind if I change the subject a little bit to more of God's attributes as opposed to the empiricism and evidence going to
that might take a 15-minute conversation. I don't know. It's up to you, Gary. You want to take it really quick? If we can.
Let's hear what...
Because God has quite a number of attributes, so... All right, go ahead.
It's probably going to take us a ways out, but if I can answer quickly, I will.
All right, go ahead, caller.
It's fine. If you want to stay on the subject, it's fine.
That's your call, Reggie.
Go ahead. Well, I think just if you can make what you're going to say quick, go ahead. Right now we're wasting time talking about it. Actually, go ahead.
Okay. My question is: do you believe in free will?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and how do you deal with the argument that with omniscience comes no free will? For example, me and God are just walking down the street and see a quarter on the ground, and God says, hey, you're going to pick up that quarter in 5 minutes. If he knows everything, and he knows everything as a fact, is there anything I can do, anything I personally can do so I can make it that I won't pick up that quarter?
Okay. If God knows something's going to happen, it's going to happen because he's omniscient. And like you said, you go, aha, where's the free will? Because let's use your example. God knows I'm going to, here's the way I would say it. There's different, as you know, there are different takes. This is a sovereignty free will issue, and I'd have a equally committed Christian sitting next to me saying Habermas is wrong. But but if God knows you're going to pick up that quarter from all eternity, then you're going to pick up that quarter. But here's the key. You are free not to. You go, well, yeah, okay, I don't want to pick up the quarter. Fine. Then God would know you're not going to pick up the quarter. So here's where I think your catch is. Whatever is going to happen, God knows it. But that doesn't mean I'm not free, because God knows it. On my view, God knows it because freely chose it.
I think this is kind of slick. This is what I like to add to it. I think the problem is when we focus just on the omniscience alone. That's not going to work. The fact of the matter is that I know most Christians believe, and some have argued it's biblically supported, that God has he has a determined plan. He has a plan about the universe, the way it begins, the way it ends, and it's in the Bible. Now, if you add this plan he has for all of mankind plus this omniscience, man simply does not have any free will, because everything is going to end. And imagine this. I take it one step back again, Gary. Before mankind was even created, before there was free will, okay, God already determined exactly the beginning and the ending of mankind. So man might feel like we have free will, but that is completely different aside from...
Are you a determinist, Reggie?
Oh boy, I'm still confused about that one actually. But I would say yes. I'm leaning very, very much toward that. Yes.
Okay. Almost all atheists are. I think that's a fair statement. But in other words, I'm not surprised. But a lot of Christians are too. You know, Calvinists. But let's use the example the fellow used, the quarter. God knows from all eternity whether you will or will not pick up the quarter. Correct.
Not just know it. He also He would plan it.
Okay. Well, let's just put it this way. It's all one. If God knows it, it will happen, right? Because God couldn't know a false fact, according to where you
are. Of course. In other words, it was set up that way. So, of course, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But you're suggesting that God made you pick up the quarter, therefore you were not free. You were not free to walk past the quarter.
Correct.
Okay. But what if, let's use that reasoning. You're arguing within the kind of a theistic Christian universe here. Does God know Reggie 10 million years before Reggie's born? On this argument.
Of course, course.
Mm-hmm. And what happens if God knows Reggie will bypass the quarter and not pick it up? What if God knows, if given the choice, you will not see, not care, not notice, will not pick up the quarter?
It'll be a false choice.
No. No, if God knows, given that
circumstance, it wouldn't be a real choice in the first place. That's the whole point.
No. Here's my point. Let's say Reggie can pick up the quarter or not pick up the quarter, and it's up to Reggie. Totally up to Reggie.
But that's what we're still trying to determine.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'm just telling you how this can work.
Okay.
If there is choice, then there is no omniscience. That means there's uncertainty.
No. Watch. If Reggie decides to pick up the quarter.
So I think.
Mm-hmm. 10 million years ago, God knew Reggie would. That's what omniscience is. 10 million years ago, God knows Reggie's going to pick up the quarter. So guess what? Reggie's going to pick up the quarter. And Reggie goes, no, I'm not free. And God says, no, I made you pick up that quarter because I knew under this circumstance you would do it. Reggie goes, no, I'm not going to pick up the quarter. Well, then 10 million years ago, God would know you weren't going to pick up the quarter, wouldn't he? Isn't that very simple? 10 million years ago, God knows.
God didn't know.
Wait a minute, guys. If God is omniscient, which is where this question started, if God knows Reggie does not pick up the quarter, then Reggie will not pick up the quarter. But what's the reason? Reggie's freedom. Reggie decided not to pick up the quarter. So that's been locked into all time. Reggie can't go down the street today and pick up the quarter.
But the problem with that, though, okay, hold on, but I'm not even created yet to...
That's right. But he's omniscient, right, guys?
But I'm not even physically existing yet. But yet you're saying he knew that in the future he'd give me free will. That doesn't even make any sense. It sounds like the Adam and Eve story. You know,
doesn't it make sense?
It's the same kind of thing. Like I'm gonna create two creatures, knowing full well that they're going to partake of this fruit because I'm gonna let the serpent in there.
Yeah,
and then I'm going to have to punish them for the rest of eternity because they're going to do exactly what I knew they do, because it's also part of my divine plan, which would mean as part of his plan is to punish humans in some way.
But part of his plan is to give us our free will. If you go back to the quarter example, Reggie, you said on this view, let's do it again, God would know you 10 million years before you were born, right?
Mm-hmm.
He'd know your mom, he'd know your dad 10 million years before you were born.
It's all planned out. Yep.
That's right. Right. It couldn't be otherwise, could it?
No, it's like the grooves on a record, baby.
Okay. So if he knows it's set in cement, correct? If he knows something, it is set in cement, i.e. it will happen.
Right. It's all part of the divine
disc. He knows all things. So when he knows when Reggie walks down the street today, Thursday, he will not pick up that quarter. He knows you won't.
Exactly. Already. But the problem is that God would then punish me.
That's a different issue. We're talking about that's the punishment thing. But on the original question about the quarter and omniscience, God can lock into all time your free choice. And that's what I believe happens.
Well,
God locks your choice into time.
Yeah. Well, let's see what this caller has. Maybe the caller has a different perspective on things. Hello?
Okay.
Hello, you're on
the air. Hello, this is Matt, Joe LaFunky from your forums.
Hey, Matt.
And one thing I was wondering is how can we have free will when, you know, there's hell there? If you think about it, hell is, you know, worse than having a gun pointed to your head and being threatened with being killed.
That doesn't work.
You
still have a choice. It may be a bad choice, but you still have a choice.
And I don't, Matt, if I'm not one of those Christians that thinks hell is God putting you on a spit and roasting you over a fire for eternity. So that'd be another show. But I agree with you. It's a really tough issue. But I don't take some of the views that, just like you'd have a Calvinist sitting next to me who's going to say, hey, I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and his death, burial, and resurrection, and I said I do to Jesus, but I disagree with Gary about picking up quarters.
Right.
Just like because Christians could be on the other side, you can get a Christian who believes hell is burning forever one inch at a time, but that's not my view.
Well, how does God know that we're going to do that thing in the future? Is it because he understands how everything's going to work out?
But remember the last caller started out his question and said, let's just say God is omniscient. Then how can he ... Well, that's the key. If you start out with a God who is omniscient, yes, God knows what you will choose. Now, if you go to the restaurant tonight and you have choices between liver and steak, you are truly free. But he knew 10 million years before you were born if you would order liver or steak tonight. So you can't do otherwise, but it's your choice.
That still doesn't make any sense.
It's a fault. a program that you understood completely, and you know that when you input A, it's going to output B. I mean, that's all we are to them if you take that point of view.
Well, it's not all we are to them.
I mean, the program can do whatever it wants.
It's exactly the opposite. You're not a computer. You're a living, thinking being. He just is big enough, great enough, omniscient enough. He knows what your options are, and he knows what you're going to choose. He treats you like a human being. There's no way he treats you like a human being.
Okay, now, even if what you said made sense, Gary, even if what you said made sense, how do you justify, though, God's demeanor when man makes certain decisions of which he already knew they'd make before he even made them? I mean, he knew that this is exactly how things are planned. So how do you explain that? God getting angry, jealous, sad, regretting?
Well, those are anthropomorphisms in Scripture, right? You're giving God human characters.
Well, I'm not giving him anything. The Bible says that.
Okay, right.
Okay, all right.
What I mean is those writers are talking about God, for example, when it says he covers us with his wings and so on and so on. Those are anthropomorphic type.
I've always thought those were just sun rays, but okay.
Okay.
It sounds like sun rays, but okay, sure.
Sun rays, okay. Well, I like eagle's wings better myself.
Well, that's exactly what the Egyptians did, by the way. They put wings on the sun.
Oh,
anyway,
I thought you meant, you meant the literal sun out there, okay.
Yeah, I did, okay. Actually.
You did?
Yes.
No, I mean not the Egyptian sun god. I don't mean that.
Same thing. But go ahead.
With which question?
I'm sorry. I interrupted you now. But
go ahead with which question. You said go ahead.
Oh, but you explaining exactly a God's demeanor and emotions, even when knowing all these things.
Well, traditional theology, yes. God doesn't act out of emotions. But God, I go back to my original point. God does know. He knows if you'll pick up the quarter. He knows what you'll order for dinner. And he knows if you will say, he knows whether or not you will say I do to Jesus. Yes, he knows all those choices.
So be good for goodness sake. I'm sorry, I just couldn't help throw that in there.
No, that's not, actually, it's not that bad. That's not that bad. Because it's set in cement. It will happen if God knows it. But that's not the reason. Mm-hmm. Everybody stops there and says, so we're all determined. No, the question is, why is it set in cement? I think it's set in cement because that's a choice he knew we would make from all eternity.
Wow, that's a switch.
Well, actually, in contemporary...
It's a choice he knew we'd make already. But this is the kicker, though, Gary. But
right.
if God would have such a problem, though, with humanity doing certain things that offend him, why make us in the damn first place?
I know you're human and we're not God. I realize that. But just to try to understand just a little bit of it.
Sure.
Why do we have children when we know children can turn out to be a blasted mess?
Because we are some selfish, ignorant fools driven by our biology. I'm telling you, I sometimes think about that all the time. It's like, man, we are
really
so selfish. What are we doing?
We're guys. Let's say it's the women.
Sure.
There are some pure-minded women out there who want to raise children because they want to raise them the right way. They want to enjoy them. They want to see them grow up. They want to see their face after they make them scrub it.
Yes.
There are people who have their head screwed on right who are raising children because they just want to see what a bright kid that minds and, you know, and I think God wants us to be bright kids who mind and who are smart.
You can't say what he wants us to do, can you?
What?
Does it even make sense to say God wants us to do something? Does it even
sure,
make sense?
God has a will.
He wants us to do something, but why would he have a want if he already knows what's going to happen?
But see, that's like back to the quarter. You are free to pick it up or not to pick
it
up.
So what the hell is this? What is this? Some kind of masochism? God is like punishing himself?
No, it's no more masochistic than the woman who raises a child who wants that child to be perfect,
no.
And the child turns out to be less than perfect. Now,
but
the analogy is not...
But we don't... Right, it's not going to be right, because the parent
no
obviously isn't omniscient. Right.
Yeah, no analogy to God is going to work. That's
right,
correct.
Right.
But what I'm saying is mothers can have pure motives or seemingly pure motives or close to pure motives. God can have pure motives. In fact, over and over again in the Bible, that metaphor is used. Even as a mother does this, so I do this for you. That sort of thing. Over and over again.
Okay.
That's the metaphor.
All right. Agree to disagree.
That's okay.
And it looks like we're going to go to 10:08 anyway. So, oh well.
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to go any further. I've got some folks that just arrived from out of state. So.
Okay. Well, we'll end with this last call, and if it's just a comment, we'll leave it at that. But if it's more than that, because this person's been holding forever.
All right.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Oh, let me turn you up.
By the way, the analogy doesn't work because parents don't have the omniscience or the ability to go ahead and, you know, punish their kids forever God does.
We said that already.
It's kind of a lame analogy, but that wasn't why I called. Okay. Follow up on the cross on the moon question. You're saying that God just wants to give us a little bit of evidence, but a cross on the moon, which would save so many people and remove so much doubt. So God doesn't really want none to perish, but all to come to repentance. That's not true.
Okay, Gary. First of all, just take that as a metaphor. Okay, and work with that.
I heard you mumbling
Yes, I did. Essentially, he's arguing God surely can provide irrefutable, sufficient evidence for his existence. If he chooses not to do that, the only logical conclusion is that either one, he wants non-believers to exist, or two, there is no Christian God. How do you respond?
Yeah, we gave one response earlier. I don't think God wants to twist our arm, so he doesn't want people who believe because he makes them to.
Well, no. I wouldn't. I mean, why is having knowledge of God in some kind of way a forced thing? I mean, God still wants us to worship him, right?
True.
So but I can God know. I can know he exists, and I worship him, and still have the free will to say, "Up yours, God." I don't believe. I think you're vicious and horrible.
If God raises Jesus on a movie screen with everybody in the world watching.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let's just say the evidence is whatever you, Reggie, need, or this caller, whatever someone needs to believe, God gave it to you. God gave you every lick of evidence you could possibly, so much so that only stupid people would not believe at this point. It's like really, really good. Well, then God has twisted your arm.
Right. Like hell, as I mentioned in the chat room. Yeah, like hell.
That's not true.
That's twisting.
Okay, and secondly, I would say, God doesn't twist arms. The other thing I would say is, and I think, Reggie, you were getting at this with the cross on the moon. I think there's almost always, it's very difficult for me to imagine a shut and closed case. You know how both of us were talking about there's no such thing as proof. There's no such thing as apodictic certainty. You could see, because an earlier caller said, how about a cross on the moon? And you said, no, because you got some idiots out there saying it's going to be aliens.
Yeah, or lasers or something else. Right. But not
so
to me, and God
sure
would know
God,
that it's not sufficient.
I'm not sure. I wonder if there can be a case out there that everyone's going to say, you got me, that's it. I think people are going to be able to think crazy things to get out
not,
of it.
Not if it's God. God is smart enough to know what evidence is sufficient for each individual.
That's correct. But now, if he's going to give every person exactly the evidence they want,
why not?
I think this is the category of twisting
arms. Okay.
Well,
here's one for you. But there are many people who believe in God precisely because they believe they have sufficient evidence. So what about those?
That's correct. Well, they do. I believe in God because I think I have sufficient evidence.
So they were twisted.
No, because I studied, I dug, I went after it.
Most Christians don't.
Pardon me?
And most believers don't.
Okay. But I'm when I was going through my years of doubt, Reggie, I was selfish enough. If you were my buddy in those days, I mean, I played football and hockey all day long and studied when I got home and that. I was no nerd. I've grown up in sports. I have 9 pinched nerves in my back to prove it. But
ow.
So I play sports during the day and come home at night, and we'd chat. But I was selfish enough that I would say, hey, my buddy Reggie here, we played football this afternoon, but frankly, I don't care where Reggie is on this one. I got questions, and I want to answer my questions. So I was selfish enough to say, I'm answering this for yours truly. I mean, I wasn't a personal quest. And if you're going to ride along,
Reg,
you know, I'm happy if you want to hear my answers. You know, you're my football player buddy, and I'm happy. But I didn't do this for you. I did it for me. I mean, that's selfish. I was answering my own questions.
Bit of a faith healer, if you don't mind me saying. If it's not sufficient evidence for you, then it's your fault you weren't saved or healed.
Oh, like The Secret, yeah.
blaming the victim. You didn't get the revelation because you read the Book of Mormon. You didn't get the burning in your bosom because it's your fault.
If that's addressed to me, I'm not hearing the question, Reggie.
Right.
I didn't hear the question.
Well, in other words, you're making that there's something wrong with the person, kind of like a faith healer would. In other words, there's something sinful or there's something inadequate or something about you because you don't have accepted evidence that is supposedly sufficient. And Reggie just addressed it perfectly, I thought. Mm-hmm. God has the power to make enough evidence for everybody sufficient, and they still have the free will that you've been arguing for.
They do. So I think they would still have the free will. But
and Gary, not to mention, many Christians always say, well, look around you. It's so evident.
We haven't said much about cosmology or intelligent design, but they might have those kind of things in book. They might have things in mind like look at the stars, look at the trees.
But it's still a level of evidence, so why wouldn't God provide sufficient? Sure. He wants to play this guessing game and risk some of us going to hell? I thought he loves us. Come on.
But he's not playing a guessing game, but I do think he wants to give you a free choice. I really do. Let's put it this way. If you believe the Bible straight up, or just look at the Bible straight up, it says God created us in his image.
Whatever that is, by the way.
Whatever that means. And that's complicated. You're right. But God, I think God is free, and I think God creates us free. So I don't think God's going to twist arms. That's just my view. I think it's born out from...
And you define twisting arms as anything beyond the level of evidence you've accepted.
Twisting arms could come in a lot of forms, but if God said...
That's a good point the caller just made. It sounds like, it doesn't sound like you're saying, oh, well, if you need any extra evidence, that got to be twisting your arm, but all the other evidence is okay.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know if this answers your question or not. C.S. Lewis has a comment. Norm Geisler, a philosopher, has a similar comment. It's something like this. If all you needed was one more argument, one more evidence to keep you out of hell, God would have given it to you. I can just tell you, I meet a lot of people who no matter their, I think this is true of all of us, I really do. Our worldviews, we judge facts by our worldviews. We all do it. It's a human phenomenon. We all look at data by where I'm coming from. I think that's true. And there are, to all of us to some extent, we're going to see a whole lot of data for something. Reggie mentioned aliens earlier. We could be seeing all kinds of data, and if my worldview says those things don't happen, I'm going to say no, 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 no matter what.
I don't know. It depends. I just want to see it and see the alternate explanations for me. I wouldn't.
Sure.
I try my best not to just discount something on the outset. That's why earlier I said, I would love to see some of these things.
And I told you, Reggie, I think you're open. I think if you were watching football with me Sunday afternoon, we'd have a good time.
I hate
we'd
football. I'd rather watch women's volleyball, but that's a different topic.
That is a different topic. No, what I'm saying is, I have a lot of atheist and non-Christian friends.
Uh-oh.
I do. And if they want to come over and watch a game, they want to go out in a boat and go fishing. I got an atheist buddy who likes to come over and go fishing. That's totally fine. We don't have to talk religion.
I'm going to let you go here, Gary. But also, and do you think God picks a favorite? Does God have a favorite football team?
Well, let's say it this way. I used to coach ice hockey for 9 years. I was a university head ice hockey coach.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Christian school, and sometimes my guys would pray in the locker room. Not everybody in my team was a Christian. My last year I had a Buddhist on the team. But sometimes the guys would pray in the locker room, and they'd say, God, give us this victory. And every time they prayed that, I would sit there, and I would just kind of shake my head, and I'd say, I don't think God cares who wins this hockey game. And I know I don't think God cares who wins the Super Bowl.
Right on.
In fact, I was on a talk show once, and that was the question, and I said no.
Right.
Reggie had a good time with you. You're a good host.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And this went very well. I think it did.
Want to work something out sometime? I'm very pleased. You know, we went off on some, you know, important issues.
But you know, I mean, the listeners wanted some of that, so we gave it to them. So
I appreciate it.
And I thank you for that.
You're a good guy.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
All right,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, caller, you're still on the line. Go ahead. We have like 9 minutes, so go ahead. What's up? Hello?
Oh, hey. I just wanted to get a quick plug for Atheists, Agnostics, Skeptics, and Humanists on MySpace. Come check out the blogs. We even have several that deal with this very issue.
All right, and that'll cost you $15. I'll be expecting that in my PayPal account within the next 5 minutes. All right, thanks.
Hey, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or Discover Card.
All of it. All right, thank you. All right, he brought up some pretty good points there. And I mean, it shows that, you know, we can argue all day long about the historicity and what people say, what people think, what's more probable, what is this, what is that. But what do we really have before us? And that was what a lot of individuals in the chat room were saying. I mean, what exactly do we have before us to work with, though? And as I mentioned before, even if all the data doesn't account for everything, that doesn't mean that we necessarily, though, need to say, the supernatural, though, explains it. Not really, because you have when you utilize the supernatural to explain something, at that point you have to also ask the who, what, when, where, why, and how. And in the realm of the supernatural, a lot of that's missing. There's no explanatory power ever in the realm of the supernatural. In fact, in the realm of the supernatural, anything is a go. So therefore, if anything is a go in that particular void, then how is there any rational foundation to getting to those conclusions in the first place? It makes more sense that a naturalistic explanation is best when trying to discover things that we don't know yet. Supernaturalistic explanations never explain anything, and they never really have. Never. Anyway, thank you all for listening and watching. I really appreciate it. Some people liked the show. Some people hated it. I thought it was okay, but it depends on what you're looking for. I think the last 45 minutes of the program, things picked up a little bit, and that is because I got a little more aggressive, and I took calls, and you guys got pretty aggressive, too. I really appreciate it. Unfortunately, my scholarly friends didn't get a chance to call in tonight. I contacted Richard Carrier, Bob Price, Jeff Lauder, Eddie Tabash. I contacted a lot of guys. Unfortunately, they couldn't make it tonight, I guess. But, or maybe they are in here. I don't know. But, oh well. I appreciate everyone coming out tonight. This show went much longer than I expected it to, so I apologize. I was hoping it was going to be just an hour, but I should have known better, right? I will see you all another time. Thank you for listening and watching In Reason.